This is Audible.
Audiobooks.com Publishing presents How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. Read by Brian Depew. Copyright 2016 by Audiobooks.com Publishing. Print copyright 1954 by Daryl Huff. Originally published by W.W. Norton & Company in 1954. Acknowledgements. The pretty little instances of bumbling and chicanery with which this book is peppered have been gathered widely and not without assistance. Following an appeal of mine through the American Statistical Association, a number of professional statisticians who, believe me, deplore the misuse of statistics as heartily as anyone alive, sent me items from their own collections. These people, I guess, will be just as glad to remain nameless here. I found valuable specimens in a number of books, too, primarily these. Business Statistics by Martin A. Brumbaugh and Lester S. Kellogg, Gauging Public Opinion by Hadley Cantrell, Graphic Presentation by Willard Cope Brinton, Practical Business Statistics by Frederick E. Cruxton and Dudley J. Cowden, Basic Statistics by George Simpson and Fritz Kafka, and Elementary Statistical Methods by Helen M. Walker. Introduction. There's a mighty lot of crime around here, said my father-in-law a little while after he moved from Iowa to California. And so there was, in the newspaper he read. It is one that overlooks no crime in its own area and has been known to give more attention to an Iowa murder than was given by the principal daily in the region in which it took place. My father-in-law's conclusion was statistical in an informal way. It was based on a sample, a remarkably biased one. Like many a more sophisticated statistic, it was guilty of semi-attachment. It assumed that newspaper space given to crime reporting is a measure of crime rate. A few winters ago, a dozen investigators independently reported figures on antihistamine pills. Each showed that a considerable percentage of colds cleared up after treatment. A great fuss ensued, at least in the advertisements, and a medical product boom was on. It was based on an eternally springing hope, and also on a curious refusal to look past the statistics to a fact that has been known for a long time. As Henry G. Felsen, a humorist and no medical authority, pointed out quite a while ago, proper treatment will cure a cold in 7 days, but left to itself, a cold will hang on for a week. So it is with much that you read and hear. Averages and relationships and trends and graphs are not always what they seem. There may be more in them than meets the eye, and there may be a good deal less. The secret language of statistics, so appealing in a fact-minded culture, is employed to sensationalize, inflate, confuse, and oversimplify. Statistical methods and statistical terms are necessary in reporting the mass data of social and economic trends, business conditions, opinion polls, the census. But without writers who use the words with honesty and understanding, and readers who know what they mean, the result can only be semantic nonsense. In popular writing on scientific matters, the abused statistic is almost crowding out the picture of the white-jacketed hero laboring overtime without time and a half in an ill-lit laboratory. Like the little dash of powder, little pot of paint, statistics are making many an important fact look like what she ain't. A well-wrapped statistic is better than Hitler's big lie. It misleads, yet it cannot be pinned on you. This book is a sort of primer in ways to use statistics to deceive. It may seem altogether too much like a manual for swindlers. Perhaps I can justify it in the manner of the retired burglar whose published reminiscences amounted to a graduate course in how to pick a lock and muffle a footfall. The crooks already know these tricks. Honest men must learn them in self-defense. Chapter 1. The sample with the built-in bias. The average Yaleman, class of 24, Time magazine noted once, commenting on something in the New York Sun, makes $25,111 a year. Well, good for him. But wait a minute. What does this impressive figure mean? Is it, as it appears to be, evidence that if you send your boy to Yale, you won't have to work in your old age, and neither will he? Two things about the figure stand out at first suspicious glance. It is surprisingly precise. It is quite improbably salubrious. There is small likelihood that the average income of any far-flung group is ever going to be known down to the dollar. It is not particularly probable that you know your own income for last year so precisely as that, unless it was all derived from salary. And $25,000 incomes are not often all salary. People in that bracket are likely to have well-scattered investments. Furthermore, this lovely average is undoubtedly calculated from the amounts the Yale men said they earned. Even if they had the honor system in New Haven in 24, we can't be sure that it works so well after a quarter of a century that all of these reports are honest ones. Some people, when asked their incomes, exaggerate out of vanity or optimism. Others minimize, especially, it is to be feared, on income tax returns. And having done this, may hesitate to contradict themselves on any other paper. Who knows what the revenuers may see? It is possible that these two tendencies, to boast and to understate, cancel each other out. But it's unlikely. One tendency may be far stronger than the other, and we do not know which one. We have begun, then, to account for a figure that common sense tells us can hardly represent the truth. Now let us put our finger on the likely source of the biggest error. A source that can produce $25,111 as the average income of some men whose actual average may well be nearer half that amount. This is the sampling procedure, which is the heart of the greater part of the statistics you meet on all sorts of subjects. Its basis is simple enough, although its refinements in practice have led into all sorts of byways, some less than respectable. If you have a barrel of beans, some red and some white, there is only one way to find out exactly how many of each color you have. Count them. However, you can find out approximately how many are red in much easier fashion by pulling out a handful of beans and counting just those, figuring that the proportion will be the same all through the barrel. If your sample is large enough and selected properly, it will represent the whole well enough for most purposes. If it is not, it may be far less accurate than an intelligent guess and have nothing to recommend it but a spurious air of scientific precision. It is sad truth that conclusions from such samples, biased or too small or both, lie behind much of what we read or think we know. The report on the Yale men comes from a sample. We can be pretty sure of that because reason tells us that no one can get a hold of all the living members of that class of 24. There are bound to be many whose addresses are unknown 25 years later. And of those whose addresses are known, many will not reply to a questionnaire, particularly a rather personal one. With some kinds of mail questionnaire, a 5 or 10% response is quite high. This one should have done better than that, but nothing like 100%. So we find that the income figure is based on a sample composed of all class members whose addresses are known and who replied to the questionnaire. Is this a representative sample? That is, can this group be assumed to be equal in income to the unrepresented group, those who cannot be reached or who do not reply? Who are the little lost sheep down in the Yale rolls as
address unknown. Are they the big income earners? The Wall Street men? The corporation directors? The manufacturing and utility executives? No, the addresses of the rich will not be hard to come by. Many of the most prosperous members of the class can be found through Who's Who in America and other reference volumes, even if they have neglected to keep in touch with the alumni office. It is a good guess that the lost names are those of the men who, 25 years or so after becoming Yale Bachelors of Arts, have not fulfilled any shining promise. They are clerks, mechanics, tramps, unemployed alcoholics, barely surviving writers and artists, people of whom it would take half a dozen or more to add up to an income of $25,111. These men do not so often register at class reunions, if only because they cannot afford the trip. Who are those who chucked the questionnaire into the nearest wastebasket? We cannot be so sure about these, but it is at least a fair guess that many of them are just not making enough money to brag about. They are a little like the fellow who found a note clipped to his first paycheck, suggesting that he consider the amount of his salary confidential and not material for the interchange of office confidences. "Don't worry," he told the boss. "I'm just as ashamed of it as you are." It becomes pretty clear that the sample has omitted two groups most likely to depress the average. The $25,111 figure is beginning to explain itself. If it is a true figure for anything, it is one merely for that special group of the class of 24 whose addresses are known and who are willing to stand up and tell how much they earn. Even that requires an assumption that the gentlemen are telling the truth. Such an assumption is not to be made lightly. Experience from one breed of sampling study, that called market research, suggests that it can hardly ever be made at all. A house-to-house survey purporting to study magazine readership was once made in which a key question was, "What magazines does your household read?" When the results were tabulated and analyzed, it appeared that a great many people loved Harper's and not very many read True Story. Now, there were publishers' figures around at the time that showed very clearly that True Story had more millions of circulation than Harper's had hundreds of thousands. "Perhaps we asked the wrong kind of people," the designers of the survey said to themselves. But no, the questions had been asked in all sorts of neighborhoods all around the country. The only reasonable conclusion, then, was that a good many of the respondents, as people are called when they answer such questions, had not told the truth. About all the survey had uncovered was snobbery. In the end, it was found that if you wanted to know what certain people read, it was no use asking them. You could learn a good deal more by going to their houses and saying you wanted to buy old magazines and what could be had. Then all you had to do was count the Yale reviews and the love romances. Even that dubious device, of course, does not tell you what people read, only what they have been exposed to. Similarly, the next time you learn from your reading that the average American, you hear a good deal about him these days, most of it faintly improbable, brushes his teeth 1.02 times a day, a figure I have just made up, but it may be as good as anyone else's, ask yourself a question. How can anyone have found out such a thing? Is a woman who has read in countless advertisements that non-brushers are social offenders going to confess to a stranger that she does not brush her teeth regularly? The statistic may have meaning to one who wants to know only what people say about toothbrushing, but it does not tell a great deal about the frequency with which bristle is applied to incisor. A river cannot, we are told, rise above its source. Well, it can seem to if there is a pumping station concealed somewhere about. It is equally true that the result of a sampling study is no better than the sample it is based on. By the time the data have been filtered through layers of statistical manipulation and reduced to a decimal-pointed average, the result begins to take on an aura of conviction that a closer look at the sampling would deny. Does early discovery of cancer save lives? Probably. But of the figures commonly used to prove it, The best that can be said is that they don't. These, the records of the Connecticut Tumor Registry, go back to 1935 and appear to show a substantial increase in the 5-year survival rate from that year till 1941. Actually, those records were begun in 1941, and everything earlier was obtained by tracing back. Many patients had left Connecticut, and whether they had lived or died could not be learned. According to the medical reporter, Leonard Engel, the built-in bias thus created is, quote, enough to account for nearly the whole of the claimed improvement in survival rate. To be worth much, a report based on sampling must use a representative sample, which is one from which every source of bias has been removed. That is where our Yale figure shows its worthlessness. It is also where a great many of the things you can read in newspapers and magazines reveal their inherent lack of meaning. A psychiatrist reported once that practically everybody is neurotic. Aside from the fact that such use destroys any meaning in the word neurotic, take a look at the man's sample. That is, whom has the psychiatrist been observing? It turns out that he has reached this edifying conclusion from studying his patients, who are a long, long way from being a sample of the population. If a man were normal, our psychiatrist would never meet him. Give that kind of second look to the things you read, and you can avoid learning a whole lot of things that are not so. It is worth keeping in mind also that the dependability of a sample can be destroyed just as easily by invisible sources of bias as by these visible ones. That is, even if you can't find a source of demonstrable bias, allow yourself some degree of skepticism about the results, as long as there is a possibility of bias somewhere. There always is. The presidential elections in 1948 and 1952 were enough to prove that, if there were any doubt. For further evidence, go back to 1936 and the Literary Digest's famed fiasco. The 10 million telephone and digest subscribers who assured the editors of the doomed magazine that it would be Landon 370, Roosevelt 161, came from the list that had accurately predicted the 1932 election. How could there be bias in a list already so tested? There was a bias, of course, as college theses and other postmortems found. People who could afford telephones and magazine subscriptions in 1936 were not a cross-section of voters. Economically, they were a special kind of people, a sample biased because it was loaded with what turned out to be Republican voters. The sample elected Landon, but the voters thought otherwise. The basic sample is the kind called random. It is selected by pure chance from the universe, a word by which the statistician means the whole of which the sample is a part. Every 10th name is pulled from a file of index cards. 50 slips of paper are taken from a hatful. Every 20th person met on Market Street is interviewed. But remember that this last is not a sample of the population of the world, or of the United States, or of San Francisco, but only of the people on Market Street at the time. One interviewer for an opinion poll said that she got her people in a railroad station, because, quote, all kinds of people can be found in a station. It had to be pointed out to her that mothers of small children, for instance, might be underrepresented there. The test of the random sample is this. Does every name or thing in the whole group have an equal chance to be in the sample? The purely random sample is the only kind that can be examined with entire confidence by means of statistical theory. But there is one thing wrong with it. It is so difficult and expensive to obtain for many uses that sheer cost eliminates it. A more economical substitute, which is almost universally used in such fields as opinion polling and market research, is called stratified random sampling. To get this stratified sample, you divide your universe into several groups in proportion to their known prevalence. And right there, your trouble can begin. Your information about their proportion may not be correct. You instruct your interviewers to see to it that they talk to so many blacks and such a such percentage of people in each of several income brackets, to a specified number of farmers, and so on. All the while, the group must be divided equally between persons over 40 and under 40 years of age. That sounds fine, but what happens? On the question of black or white, the interviewer will judge correctly most of the time. On income, he will make more mistakes. As to farmers, how do you classify a man who farms part-time and works in the city, too? Even the question of age can pose some problems that are most easily settled by choosing only respondents who obviously are well under or well over 40. In that case, the sample will be biased by the virtual absence of the late 30s and early 40s age groups. You can't win. On top of all this, how do you get a random sample within the stratification? The obvious thing is to start with a list of everybody and go after the names chosen from it at random. But that's too expensive. So you go into the streets and bias your sample against stay-at-homes. You go from door to door by day and miss most of the employed people. You switch to evening interviews and neglect the moviegoers and nightclubbers. The operation of a poll comes down in the end to a running battle against sources of bias. And this battle is conducted all the time by all the reputable polling organizations. What the reader of the reports must remember is that the battle is never won. No conclusion that 67% of the American people are against something or other should be read without the lingering question, 67% of which American people? So with Dr. Alfred C. Kinsey's Female Volume. The problem, as with anything based on sampling, is how to read it, or a popular summary of it, without learning too much that is not necessarily so. There are at least three levels of sampling involved. Dr. Kinsey's samples of the population, one level, are far from random ones, and may not be particularly representative, but they are enormous samples by comparison with anything done in his field before, and his figures must be accepted as revealing and important, if not necessarily, on the nose. It is possibly more important to remember that any questionnaire is only a sample, another level, of the possible questions, and that the answer the lady gives is no more than a sample, third level, of her attitudes and experiences on each question. The kind of people who make up the interviewing staff can shade the result in an interesting fashion. Some years ago, during the war, the National Opinion Research Center sent out two staffs of interviewers to ask three questions of 500 blacks in a southern city. White interviewers made up one staff, blacks the other. One question was, would blacks be treated better or worse here if the Japanese conquered the USA? Black interviewers reported that 9% of those they asked said, better. White interviewers found only 2% of such responses. And while black interviewers found only 25% who thought blacks would be treated worse, white interviewers turned up 45%. When Nazis was substituted for Japanese in the question, the results were similar. The third question probed attitudes that might be based on feelings revealed by the first two. Do you think it's more important to concentrate on beating the Axis or to make democracy work better here at home? Beat Axis was the reply of 39%, according to the black interviewers, of 62%, according to the white. Here is bias introduced by unknown factors. It seems likely that the most effective factor was a tendency that must always be allowed for in reading poll results, a desire to give a pleasing answer. Would it be any wonder if, when answering a question with connotations of disloyalty in wartime, a southern black would tell a white man what sounded good rather than what he actually believed? It is also possible that the different groups of interviewers chose different kinds of people to talk to. In any case, the results are obviously so biased as to be worthless. You can judge for yourself how many other poll-based conclusions are just as biased, just as worthless, but with no check available to show them up. You have pretty fair evidence to go on if you suspect that polls in general are biased in one specific direction, the direction of the Literary Digest error. This bias is toward the person with more money, more education, more information and alertness, better appearance, more conventional behavior, and more settled habits than the average of the population he's chosen to represent. You can easily see what produces this. Let's say that you're an interviewer assigned to a street corner, with one interview to get. You spot two men who seem to fit the category you must complete, over 40 and urban. One is in clean clothes, neat. The other is dirty, and he looks surly. With a job to get done, you approach the more likely-looking fellow, and your colleagues all over the country are making similar decisions. Some of the strongest feeling against public opinion polls is found in liberal or left-wing circles, where it is rather commonly believed that polls are generally rigged. Behind this view is the fact that polls so often fail to square with the opinions and desires of those whose thinking is not in the conservative direction. Polls, they point out, seem to elect Republicans, even when voters shortly thereafter do otherwise. Actually, as we have seen, it's not necessary that a poll be rigged, that is, that the results be deliberately twisted in order to create a false impression. The tendency of the sample to be biased in this consistent direction can rig it automatically. Chapter 2. The Well-Chosen Average. You, I trust, are not a snob, and I certainly am not in the real estate business. But let's say that you are, and I am, and that you're looking for property to buy along a road that is not far from the California Valley in which I live. Having sized you up, I take pains to tell you that the average income in this neighborhood is some $15,000 a year. Maybe that clinches your interest in living here. Anyway, you buy, and that handsome figure sticks in your mind. More than likely, since we've agreed that for the purposes of the moment you are a bit of a snob, you toss it in casually when telling your friends about where you live. A year or so later, we meet again. As a member of some taxpayers' committee, I am circulating a petition to keep the tax rate down, or assessments down, or bus fare down. My plea is that we cannot afford the increase. After all, the average income in this neighborhood is only $3,500 a year. Perhaps you go along with me and my committee in this. You're not only a snob, you're stingy too. But you can't help but be surprised to hear about that measly $3,500. Am I lying now, or was I lying last year? You can't pin it on me either time. That is the essential beauty of doing your lying with statistics. Both those figures are legitimate averages, legally arrived at. Both represent the same data, the same people, the same incomes. All the same, it is obvious that at least one of them must be so misleading as to rival an out-and-out lie. My trick was to use a different kind of average each time, the word average having a very loose meaning. It is a trick commonly used, sometimes in innocence, but often in guilt, by fellows wishing to influence public opinion or sell advertising space. When you're told that something is an average, you still don't know very much about it, unless you can find out which of the common kinds of average it is, mean, median, or mode. The $15,000 figure I used when I wanted a big one is a mean, the arithmetic average of all the incomes of all the families in the neighborhood. You get it by adding up all the incomes and dividing by the number that there are. The smaller figure is a median, and so it tells you that half the families in question have more than $3,500 a year, and half have less. I might also have used the mode, which is the most frequently met with figure in a series. If, in this neighborhood, there are more families with incomes of $5,000 a year than any other amount, $5,000 a year is the modal income. In this case, as usually is true with income figures, an unqualified average is virtually meaningless. One factor that adds to the confusion is that with some kinds of information, all the averages fall so close together that, for casual purposes, it may not be vital to distinguish among them. If you read that the average height of the men of some group of people is only 5 feet, you get a fairly good idea of the stature of these people. You don't have to ask whether that average is a mean, median, or mode.
it would come out about the same. Of course, if you're in the business of manufacturing overalls for these men, you would want more information than can be found in any average. This has to do with ranges and deviations, and we'll tackle that one in the next chapter. The different averages come out close together when you deal with data, such as those having to do with many human characteristics, that have the grace to fall close to what is called the normal distribution. If you draw a curve to represent it, you get something shaped like a bell, and mean, median, and mode fall at the same point. Consequently, one kind of average is as good as another for describing the heights of men, but for describing their pocketbooks, it is not. If you should list the annual incomes of all the families in a given city, you might find that they ranged from not so much to perhaps $50,000 or so, and you might find a few very large ones. More than 95% of the incomes would be under $10,000, putting them way over toward the left-hand side of the curve. Instead of being symmetrical, like a bell, it would be skewed. Its shape would be a little like that of a child's slide, the latter rising sharply to a peak, the working part sloping gradually down. The mean would be quite a distance from the median. You can see what this would do to the validity of any comparison made between the average mean of 1 year and the average median of another. In the neighborhood where I sold you some property, the two averages are particularly far apart because the distribution is markedly skewed. It happens that most of your neighbors are small farmers or wage earners employed in a nearby village, or elderly retired people on pensions. But three of the inhabitants are millionaire weekenders, and these three boost the total income, and therefore the arithmetic average, enormously. They boost it to a figure that practically everybody in the neighborhood has a good deal less than. You have, in reality, the case that sounds like a joke or a figure of speech. Nearly everybody is below average. That's why, when you read an announcement by a corporation executive or a business proprietor that the average pay of the people who work in his establishment is so much, the figure may mean something, and it may not. If the average is a median, you can learn something significant from it. Half the employees make more than that, half the employees make less. But if it is a mean, and believe me, it may be that if its nature is unspecified, you may be getting nothing more revealing than the average of one $45,000 income, the proprietor's, and the salaries of a crew of underpaid workers. Average annual pay of $5,700 may conceal both the $2,000 salaries and the owner's profits, taken in the form of a whopping salary. Let's take a longer look at that one. The facing page shows how many people get how much. The boss might like to express the situation as average wage $5,700, using that deceptive mean. The mode, however, is more revealing. Most common rate of pay in this business is $2,000 a year. As usual, the median tells more about the situation than any other single figure does. Half the people get more than $3,000, and half get less. How neatly this can be worked into a whipsaw device in which the worse the story, the better it looks, is illustrated in some company statements. Let's try our hand at one in a small way. You are one of the three partners who own a small manufacturing business. It is now the end of a very good year. You have paid out $198,000 to the 90 employees who do the work of making and shipping the chairs or whatever it is that you manufacture. You and your partners have paid yourselves $11,000 each in salaries. You find there are profits for the year of $45,000 to be divided equally among you. How are you going to describe this? To make it easy to understand, you put it in the form of averages. Since all the employees are doing about the same kind of work for similar pay, it won't make much difference whether you use a mean or a median. This is what you come out with. Average wage of employees, $2,200. Average salary and profit of owners, $26,000. That looks terrible, doesn't it? Let's try it another way. Take $30,000 of the profits and distribute it among the three partners as bonuses,
And this time, when you average up the wages, include yourself and your partners. And be sure to use a mean. Average wage or salary, $2,806.45. Average profit of owners, $5,000. Ah, that looks better. Not as good as you could make it look, but good enough. Less than 6% of the money available for wages and profits has gone into profits. And you can go further and show that too if you like. Anyway, you've got figures now that you can publish, post on a bulletin board, or use in bargaining. This is pretty crude because the example is simplified, but it is nothing to what has been done in the name of accounting. Given a complex corporation with hierarchies of employees, ranging all the way from beginning typist to president with a several $100,000 bonus, all sorts of things can be covered up in this manner. So when you see an average pay figure, first ask, average of what? Who's included? The United States Steel Corporation once said that its employees' average weekly earnings went up 107% between 1940 and 1948. So they did, but some of the punch goes out of that magnificent increase when you note that the 1940 figure includes a much larger number of partially employed people. If you work half-time one year and full-time the next, your earnings will double, but that doesn't indicate anything at all about your wage rate. You may have read in the paper that the income of the average American family was $3,100 in 1949. You shouldn't try to make too much out of that figure unless you also know what family has been used to mean, as well as what kind of average this is, and who says so and how he knows and how accurate the figure is. This one happens to have come from the Bureau of the Census. If you have the Bureau's report, you'll have no trouble finding the rest of the information you need right there. This is a median. Family signifies two or more persons related to each other and living together. If persons living alone are included in the group, the median slips to $2,700, which is quite different. You will also learn, if you read back into the tables, that the figure is based on a sample of such size that there are 19 chances out of 20 that the estimate, $3,107 before it was rounded, is correct within a margin of $59 plus or minus. That probability and that margin add up to a pretty good estimate. The census people have both skill enough and money enough to bring their sampling studies down to a fair degree of precision. Presumably, they have no particular axes to grind. Not all the figures you see are born under such happy circumstances, nor are all of them accompanied by any information at all to show how precise or unprecise they may be. We'll work that one over in the next chapter. Meanwhile, you may want to try out your skepticism on some items from A Letter from the Publisher in Time magazine. Of new subscribers, it said, their median age is 34 years, and their average family income is $7,270 a year. An earlier survey of old-timers had found that their median age was 41, and average income was $9,535. The natural question is, why, when median is given for ages both times, the kind of average for incomes is carefully unspecified? Could it be that the mean was used instead because it is bigger, thus seeming to dangle a richer readership before advertisers? You might also try a game of what kind of average are you on the alleged prosperity of the 1924 Yales, reported at the beginning of Chapter 1. Chapter 3. The Little Figures That Are Not There. Users report 23% fewer cavities with Doakes toothpaste, the big type says. You could do with 23% fewer aches, so you read on. These results, you find, come from a reassuringly independent laboratory, and the account is certified by a certified public accountant. What more do you want? Yet, if you are not outstandingly gullible or optimistic, you will recall from experience that one toothpaste is seldom much better than any other. Then how can the Doakes people report such results? Can they get away with telling lies, and in such big type at that? No,
and they don't have to. There are easier ways and more effective ones. The principal joker in this one is the inadequate sample. Statistically inadequate, that is. For Doakes's purpose, it is just right. That test group of users, you discover by reading the small type, consisted of just a dozen persons. You have to hand it to Doakes at that for giving you a sporting chance. Some advertisers would omit this information and leave even the statistically sophisticated only a guess as to what species of chicanery was afoot. His sample of a dozen isn't so bad either as these things go. Something called Dr. Cornish's tooth powder came onto the market a few years ago, with a claim to have shown considerable success in correction of dental caries. The idea was that the powder contained urea, which laboratory work was supposed to have demonstrated to be valuable for the purpose. The pointlessness of this was that the experimental work had been purely preliminary and had been done on precisely 6 cases. But let's get back to how easy it is for Doakes to get a headline without a falsehood in it, and everything certified at that. Let any small group of persons keep count of cavities for 6 months, then switch to Doakes. One of 3 things is bound to happen. Distinctly more cavities, distinctly fewer, or about the same number. If the first or last of these possibilities occurs, Doakes and company file the figures, well out of sight somewhere, and tries again. Sooner or later, by the operation of chance, a test group is going to show a big improvement worthy of a headline, and perhaps a whole advertising campaign. This will happen whether they adopt Doakes, or baking soda, or just keep on using their same old dentifrice. The importance of using a small group is this. With a large group, any difference produced by chance is likely to be a small one and unworthy of big type. A 2% improvement claim is not going to sell much toothpaste. How results that are not indicative of anything can be produced by pure chance, given a small enough number of cases, is something you can test for yourself at a small cost. Just start tossing a penny. How often will it come up heads? Half the time, of course. Everyone knows that. Well, let's check that and see. I've just tried 10 tosses and got heads 8 times, which proves that pennies come up heads 80% of the time. Well, by toothpaste statistics, they do. Now try it yourself. You may get a 50-50 result, but probably you won't. Your result, like mine, stands a good chance of being quite a ways from 50-50. But if your patience holds out for 1,000 tosses, you are almost, though not quite, certain to come out with a result very close to half heads. A result, that is, which represents the real probability. Only when there is a substantial number of trials involved is the law of averages a useful description or prediction. How many is enough? That's a tricky one, too. It depends, among other things, on how large and how varied a population you are studying by sampling. And sometimes the number in the sample is not what it appears to be. A remarkable instance of this came out in connection with a test of a polio vaccine a few years ago. It appeared to be an impressively large-scale experiment, as medical ones go. 450 children were vaccinated in a community, and 680 were left unvaccinated, as controls. Shortly thereafter, the community was visited by an epidemic. Not one of the vaccinated children contracted a recognizable case of polio. Neither did any of the controls. What the experimenters had overlooked, or not understood, in setting up their project was the low incidence of paralytic polio. At the usual rate, only 2 cases would have been expected in a group this size, and so the test was doomed from the start to have no meaning. Something like 15 to 25 times this many children would have been needed to obtain an answer signifying anything. Many a great, if fleeting, medical discovery has been launched similarly. Make haste, as one physician puts it, to use a new remedy before it's too late. The guilt does not always lie with the medical profession alone. Public pressure and hasty journalism often launch a treatment that is unproved, particularly when the demand is great and the statistical background hazy.
So it was with the cold vaccines that were popular some years back, and the antihistamines more recently. A good deal of the popularity of these unsuccessful cures sprang from the unreliable nature of the ailment, and from a defect of logic. Given time, a cold will cure itself. How can you avoid being fooled by unconclusive results? Must every man be his own statistician and study the raw data for himself? It's not that bad. There is a test of significance that is easy to understand. It is a simple way of reporting how likely it is that a test figure represents a real result rather than something produced by chance. This is the little figure that is not there, on the assumption that you, the lay reader, wouldn't understand it, or that, where there's an axe to grind, you would. If the source of your information gives you also the degree of significance, you'll have a better idea of where you stand. This degree of significance is most simply expressed as a probability, as when the Bureau of the Census tells you that there are 19 chances out of 20 that their figures have a specified degree of precision. For most purposes, nothing poorer than this 5% level of significance is good enough. For some, the demanded level is 1%, which means that there are 99 chances out of 100 that an apparent difference, or whatnot, is real. Anything this likely is sometimes described as practically certain. There's another kind of little figure that is not there, one whose absence can be just as damaging. It is the one that tells the range of things, or their deviation from the average that is given. Often an average, whether mean or median, specified or unspecified, is such an oversimplification that it is worse than useless. Knowing nothing about a subject is frequently healthier than knowing what is not so, and a little learning may be a dangerous thing. Altogether too much of recent American housing, for instance, has been planned to fit the statistically average family of 3.6 persons. Translated into reality, this means three or four persons, which, in turn, means two bedrooms. And this size family, average though it is, actually makes up a minority of all families. We build average houses for average families, say the builders, and neglect the majority that are larger or smaller. Some areas, in consequence of this, have been overbuilt with two-bedroom houses, underbuilt in respect to smaller and larger units. So here is a statistic whose misleading incompleteness has had expensive consequences. Of it, the American Public Health Association says, quote, "When we look beyond the arithmetical average to the actual range which it misrepresents, we find that the three-person and four-person families make up only 45% of the total. 35% are one person and two person. 20% have more than four persons." End quote. Common sense has somehow failed in the face of the convincingly precise and authoritative 3.6. It has somehow outweighed what everybody knows from observation, that many families are small and quite a few are large. In somewhat the same fashion, those little figures that are missing from what are called Gissell's norms have produced pain in papas and mamas. Let a parent read, as many have done in such places as Sunday rotogravure sections, that a child learns to sit erect at the age of so many months, and he thinks at once of his own child. Let his child fail to sit by the specified age, and the parent must conclude that his offspring is retarded or subnormal or something equally invidious. Since half the children are bound to fail to sit by the time mentioned, a good many parents are made unhappy. Of course, speaking mathematically, this unhappiness is balanced by the joy of the other 50% of parents in discovering that their children are advanced. But harm can come of the efforts of the unhappy parents to force their children to conform to the norms and thus be backward no longer. All this does not reflect on Dr. Arnold Gissell or his methods. The fault is in the filtering down process, from the researcher through the sensational or ill-informed writer, to the reader who fails to miss the figures that have disappeared in the process. A good deal of the misunderstanding can be avoided if to the norm or average is added an indication of the range. Parents seeing that their youngsters fall within the normal range we'll quit worrying about small and meaningless differences. Hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way. Just as 100 pennies tossed will rarely come up exactly 50 heads and 50 tails. Confusing normal with desirable makes it all the worse. Dr. Giselle simply stated some observed facts. It was the parents who, in reading the books and articles, concluded that a child who walks late by a day or a month must be inferior. A good deal of the stupid criticism of Dr. Alfred Kinsey's well-known, if hardly well-read, report came from taking normal to be equivalent to good, right, desirable. Dr. Kinsey was accused of corrupting youth by giving them ideas, and particularly by calling all sorts of popular but unapproved sexual practices normal. But he simply said that he had found these activities to be usual, which is what normal means, and he did not stamp them with any seal of approval. Whether they were naughty or not did not come within what Dr. Kinsey considered to be his province. So he ran up against something that has plagued many another observer. It is dangerous to mention any subject having high emotional content without hastily saying whether you are for or against it. The deceptive thing about the little figure that is not there is that its absence so often goes unnoticed. That, of course, is the secret of its success. Critics of journalism as practiced today have deplored the paucity of good old-fashioned legwork and spoken harshly of Washington's armchair correspondents, who live by uncritically rewriting government handouts. For a sample of unenterprising journalism, take this item from a list of new industrial developments in the news magazine Fortnight. Quote, "A new cold temper bath which triples the hardness of steel," from Westinghouse. Now, that sounds like quite a development, until you try to put your finger on what it means, and then it becomes as elusive as a ball of quicksilver. Does the new bath make just any kind of steel three times as hard as it was before treatment? Or does it produce a steel three times as hard as any previous steel? Or what does it do? It appears that the reporter has passed along some words without inquiring what they mean, and you are expected to read them just as uncritically for the happy illusion they give you of having learned something. It's all too reminiscent of an old definition of the lecture method of classroom instruction, a process by which the contents of the textbook of the instructor are transferred to the notebook of the student, without passing through the heads of either party. A few minutes ago, while looking up something about Dr. Kinsey in Time, I came upon another of those statements that collapse under a second look. It appeared in an advertisement by a group of electric companies in 1948. Quote, "Today, electric power is available to more than three-quarters of U.S. farms." That sounds pretty good. Those power companies are really on the job. Of course, if you wanted to be ornery, you could paraphrase it into, "Almost one-quarter of U.S. farms do not have electric power available today." The real gimmick, however, is in that word, available. And by using it, the companies have been able to say just about anything they please. Obviously, this doesn't mean that all those farmers actually have power, or the advertisement surely would have said so. They merely have it available. And that, for all I know, could mean that the power lines go past their farms or merely within 10 or 100 miles of them. Let me quote a title from an article published in Collier's in 1952. "You can tell now how tall your child will grow." With the article is conspicuously displayed a pair of charts, one for boys and one for girls, showing what percentage of his ultimate height a child reaches at each year of age. "To determine your child's height at maturity," says the caption, "check present measurement against chart." The funny thing about this is that the article itself, if you read on, tells you what the fatal weakness in the chart is. Not all children grow in the same way. Some start slowly and then speed up. Others shoot up quickly for a while, then level off slowly. For still others, growth is a relatively steady process. The chart, as you might guess, is based on averages taken from a large number of measurements.
For the total, or average, heights of 100 youngsters taken at random, it is no doubt accurate enough. But a parent is interested in only one height at a time, a purpose for which such a chart is virtually worthless. If you wish to know how tall your child is going to be, you can probably make a better guess by taking a look at his parents and grandparents. That method isn't scientific and precise like the chart, but it is at least as accurate. I'm amused to note that, taking my height as recorded when I enrolled in high school military training at 14 and ended up in the rear rank of the smallest squad, I should eventually have grown to a bare 5 feet 8. I am 5 feet 11. A 3-inch error in human height comes down to a poor grade of guess. Before me are wrappers from two boxes of Grape Nuts Flakes. They are slightly different additions, as indicated by their testimonials. One cites Two Gun Pete, and the other says, "If you want to be like Hoppy, you've got to eat like Hoppy." Both offer charts to show, scientists proved it's true, that these flakes start giving you energy in 2 minutes. In one case, the chart hidden in these forests of exclamation points has numbers up the side. In the other case, the numbers have been omitted. This is just as well, since there's no hint of what the numbers mean. Both show a steeply climbing red line, energy release. But one has it starting 1 minute after eating Grape Nuts Flakes, the other 2 minutes later. One line climbs about twice as fast as the other, too, suggesting that even the draftsmen didn't think these graphs meant anything. Such foolishness could only be found on material meant for the eye of a juvenile, or his morning-weary parent, of course. No one would insult a big businessman's intelligence with such statistical tripe. Or would he? Let me tell you about a graph used to advertise an advertising agency. I hope this isn't getting confusing. In the rather special columns of Fortune magazine. The line on this graph showed the impressive upward trend of the agency's business year by year. There were no numbers. With equal honesty, this chart could have represented a tremendous growth, with business doubling or increasing by millions of dollars a year, or the snail-like progress of a static concern adding only a dollar or two to its annual billings. It made a striking picture, though. Place little faith in an average or a graph or a trend when those important figures are missing. Otherwise, you're as blind as a man choosing a campsite from a report of mean temperature alone. You might take 61 degrees as a comfortable annual mean, giving you a choice in California between such areas as the Inland Desert and San Nicolas Island off the south coast. But you can freeze or roast if you ignore the range. For San Nicolas, it's 47 to 87 degrees, but for the desert, it's 15 to 104. Oklahoma City can claim a similar average temperature for the last 60 years, 60.2 degrees. But as you can see from the chart below, that cool and comfortable figure conceals a range of 130 degrees. Chapter 4. Much Ado About Practically Nothing. If you don't mind, we'll begin by endowing you with two children. Peter and Linda, we might as well give them modish names while we're about it, have been given intelligence tests, as a great many children are in the course of their schooling. Now, the mental test of any variety is one of the prime voodoo fetishes of our time, so you may have to argue a little to find out the results of the tests. This is information so esoteric that it is often held to be safe only in the hands of psychologists and educators, and they may be right at that. Anyway, you learn somehow that Peter's IQ is 98 and Linda's is 101. You know, of course, that the IQ is based on 100 as average or normal. Aha! Linda is your brighter child. She is, furthermore, above average. Peter is below average, but let's not dwell on that. Any such conclusions as these are sheer nonsense. Just to clear the air, let's note first of all that whatever an intelligence test measures, it's not quite the same thing as we usually mean by intelligence. It neglects such important things as leadership and creative imagination, It takes no account of social judgment or musical or artistic or other aptitudes, to say nothing of such personality matters as diligence and emotional balance. On top of that, the tests most often given in schools are the quick and cheap group kind that depend a good deal upon reading facility,